in order. We have a quorum, and I have coffee. Thanks to Representative Johnson. And has anyone had a chance to look at the minutes?
Madam Chair, I moved the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 4th.
That motion is before you. Any corrections? All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. And we have Representative Fisher up. And Representative Fisher, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 3625 to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
And my understanding is you have an author's amendment.
Yes, I do. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A20-0698A amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
And do you want to speak to the amendment?
Sure. What the amendment does is it just changes the cutoff date for when manufactured home parts can reduce the amount that they have to pay into the trust fund. Right now it's at 90 days. This would reduce it down to 60 days. There has been no concern on it that I've heard at this point in time.
Any comment to the amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? That amendment is adopted.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3625 as amended. It's a very simple bill. What it would do is that in manufactured home parks, it would allow modular homes to be not just single family, but also in a duplex situation. This would still be subject to rules within the local communities would still apply in this type of situation, just allowing a little bit more flexibility for housing sizes, and also to allow more affordability to happen in the modular home situation. I do have a testifier today with me, Mr. Bruner. If it pleases the committee, he could testify at this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Fisher for bringing the bill. And as he said, it just simply tightens up a timeline for payments to the Relocation Trust Fund. It started out at 30 days, went to 90 days. Now we're going to 60, and that seems to be pretty easy, good common ground. The other part of the bill allowing duplex modular homes in a manufactured home community. Again, it's just follow-up to last session when the legislature changed a 1950s law that only allowed manufactured homes to be placed in a manufactured home community so that smaller duplexes now could be placed in a manufactured home park under the law. So you'd still have to comply with all existing zoning land use requirements. Doesn't change anything. The league's not opposed to the change.
We have one question. Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, Representative Fisher, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. In fact, I was in a modular home over the weekend where my son was helping my father-in-law do the painting in a new addition in the mobile modular home park in my city. Looking at those new homes, they are very nice, and it's surprising when you put a double or a triple wide in how big they are. And by being able to make them into a duplex, it's going to be even more advantageous in some of these communities. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We have no other questions. Any concluding comments?
No, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. This is a great bill. Let's vote yes.
Representative Fisher renews his motion that House File 3625, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. You still have one other committee.
That is correct.
To go to here. No further questions. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? That is adopted. Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move 3454
to be passed and sent to the General Register.
Welcome.
Thank you.
To the bill.
One note that some of you may have picked up at this particular point in time is the companion bill got dropped yesterday. So there is one, and it is...
There is a Senate bill.
Tiptoed into the system, so...
And it looks like this is a department bill.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Essentially, what this deals with is the issue of funding for one of the, those of us that have had a career in real estate for one of the agencies that provides the most practical and pragmatic access to funding and oftentimes to sales in the real estate market across all types of homes, whether from singular, single-family homes all the way into other types, apartment buildings and that sort of thing. So we are, I'm particularly very happy to support the agency in getting this support in their mission. I'll turn it over to testifier for their comments and maybe answer questions that may come up.
Mr. Kitzberger, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm with Minnesota Housing. As was indicated, this is an agency bill. This is a priority for the governor. This deals with the rehab loan program, which is one of our appropriated sources that we receive from you annually. This is a program that's targeted at very low-income homeowners, typically below 30% of AMI, and it deals with basic health and safety improvements to single-family homes to help people stay in their homes longer and avoid a costly and disruptive relocation. It also happens to be one of our more active programs as it relates to manufactured housing, in large part due to the kind of the intersection between that type of housing and a lower income homeowner demographic. So since 2014, we've done over 250 loans to manufactured home owners, and that includes what you would think of as a single wide, so those taxed as personal property. But what we often find with those particular properties is that we're loaning in a much larger amount than the home is actually worth. And so what we're hoping to do in those situations, it should there be an available unit, is to just replace the existing unit with a lightly used newer model. We've actually piloted this out of another one of our existing appropriated programs, the Challenge Fund, which many of you might be familiar with. We did a grant to the Minnesota Valley Action Council out of Mankato to replace five manufactured homes through that program. And there have been various iterations of this done in the past. Actually, at the federal level, CDBG had some funding available to replace manufactured homes for homeowners as well. So again, this wouldn't be done necessarily in all circumstances. We'd just like the option to be available to us when it's appropriate. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Questions of the Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kitzberger. The other component of this is you're removing the cap on the loan not exceeding 110%. Can you give us a little more of an explanation of that? And did we consider, if we're removing 110%, did we consider a new ceiling instead of now it'll just be an unlimited amount? Is yeah.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, that has to do really with the amount. When we run into these situations, particularly with homes taxed as personal property, I believe the average home value is something just north of $10,000, whereas the average loan amount we're providing is north of $20,000. And so I think we wanted to ensure that option in case we aren't able to source a lightly used manufactured home, that we are still able to provide a loan. Some of these situations can be sort of time sensitive, and so we just want to ensure that we have those tools in the toolbox to address those homeowners when needed.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that answer. That certainly does make sense. But this removing this would apply to all those forms of housing, not just modular homes. So are we potentially putting people who are really in dire straits looking for housing, are we maybe putting them in a financial risk position? And again, I'm a realtor, so I'm all for home ownership, and I really do believe in these programs. I'm asking the question just from the standpoint, again, I get the $10,000 to $20,000. That seems like a no-brainer, right? Because that's still a very inexpensive unit for someone to live in. But if we're talking about a $120,000 house that we're now putting $240,000 in a neighborhood that will never exceed $180,000 of value. And again, just a open question. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, I should have addressed that on the front end. That's a good point. The average loan amount out of this program overall is about $25,000. These are loans to homeowners who would not qualify in a traditional lending marketplace. These are zero interest deferred loans, and so we're really looking to homeowners to make sure that we're not creating a burdensome situation. And oftentimes, because this is an appropriated program, we have some flexibility in terms of those repayments that get made. And so I don't see us in a situation. In fact, I would be hard pressed to find a situation in which we've lent that amount of money just based on the types of things we're doing to these homes. It's very basic, you know, accessibility and energy efficiency improvements to keep people in their homes.
Follow up. Any further? We have no other questions here. Any concluding comments?
No, Madam Chair. Again, I just want to appreciate. I just appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill. We have seen it. You know, obviously a greater emphasis on manufactured housing generally, and we want to demonstrate that that's something we're thinking a lot about as well.
We didn't have an overview from the department because we had to get right into bills, but I think one of the questions we always have, this is separate from this bill, but you're before us right now, is we always want to assure that whatever funding we do for housing goes all over the state, that and we often ask for a map. And we may not have time for an overview, but maybe the map would be helpful just to understand the work you do. The gentleman sitting next to you, for example, he and I just talked about this yesterday, wondering funding, for example, in the Rochester area. I mean, you have that type of information, and maybe a map just to show that money that the department allocates to housing, in fact, goes all over the state.
Madam Chair, we could certainly do that. Just to clarify, is this something you're interested for all programs, or just this the particular program covered in this
how
bill?
Do you, I don't know how you quantify. Do you have it for all programs? Or?
Yes. Madam Chair, it's certainly something we could produce. It would be a pretty busy map.
Yeah.
So if, you know, it's potential we could produce a couple of different maps by program. We could do one specifically for bonds, for example, another specifically for appropriated programs.
And the reason I mention it, there are two bills that have just been introduced last week where money would just go to Greater Minnesota outside of the seven county metro area. And I think there's a feeling, perhaps by those authors, that nothing goes outside. And so, you know, to get some understanding of the fact that we know you always are understanding that you need to be fair to the entire state.
Sure.
In every year. So however that, in whatever way that you can provide that information.
Madam Chair, we'll take a look at, we'll maybe think through the different options for presenting that in a way that might make sense and hopefully be helpful to the committee. So I can maybe work with you and staff to think about how we might portray that.
To the author, any concluding comments?
And I would offer to the MFHA that persons like myself and others who have experience in the real estate market and using their product, that we could assist them in identifying what is pertinent. Because I agree with him is that if we saw a map of all of it for the last 5 years, the map would essentially be a solid set of colors. So I would offer myself if they're interested in that advice. The other thing that I wanted to say for the benefit of the community, this is going to be a very common type of concern because laws and statutes have fallen way behind in terms of the different types of housing that we use in the market. And that the type of housing is going to change and move quickly
because there is nothing more affordable right now in the market than manufactured homes in terms of providing housing. It's a different thing to get used to. It takes a different kind of process and oftentimes some tweaks or changes to either local or statewide statutes. So I offer that it's good for you to get used to the sensitivity that this is a change in the real estate market that is based on housing and the cost of housing, and it's being driven because this kind of housing can come in at a much more favorable and competitive price point. So that's just an offer that this could get busy.
Representative Salk renews his motion that House File 3454 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That motion is passed, and you are on your way. And we just had our next author come in, I think. Representative Herr. Fisher's is done. Okay. I think all of your bills go to judiciary. It seems to me this one also is heading there.
That's exactly it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. And I would like to move my bill to be re-referred to judiciary.
So her moves that 3759 be referred to judiciary, finance, and civil law. And you have, an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I do have one amendment, and that amendment actually just gets the bill in the order that I would need to present it today and to go over the amendment. Let me just see that. Sorry, it's one of those moments, one of those days, Madam Chair. So it just, what the amendment does is it actually defines what prorated means so that there's no ambiguity in how the days remaining rents would be prorated. So.
To the 820 author's amendment, there are no questions. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That amendment is adopted.
So thank you, Madam Chair and committee. So in front of you, you have House File 3759. And what 3759 is that it prorates rent for the amount of time the renter is actually in that space before they are out. And oftentimes now when renters sign a lease, it says that they will pay for the full month even if they are asked to be out of the unit before the month is over. And I think that this is a really great bill. And so what I would like to do is just to make sure that we have time for questions. I'm just gonna turn it over to my first testifier. And will it be you? And so my first testifier is Sam, and he is a U of M student.
Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Well, thank you, Chair Hausman and members of the committee. My name is Sam Parmakar. I am the state government coordinator for the Minnesota Student Association. We're the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and we represent about 35,000 undergraduate students. I'm here today to encourage you to pass House File 3759, which provides student tenants with some important protections to ensure fair leasing tactics. In particular, I want to speak about Section 1, which requires prorated rent for short-end leases. For those that aren't familiar, short-end leases are a common feature of leases around college campuses, wherein a tenant that enters into a 12-month lease, typically on September 1st, is required to move out partway through the last month, which is usually in mid-August. These provisions exist because many landlords will lease primarily or exclusively to students, meaning most of their units are turning over at the beginning of the semester. This period at the end of August, where units aren't being occupied, gives management the opportunity to make repairs and clean units before new tenants move in. The practice in and of itself is not unreasonable, but what is unreasonable is the fact that most student tenants are charged a full last month's rent when they're only allowed to occupy the unit for part of the month. When I had to move out of my apartment on August 12th last year, I was lucky to be able to move back in with my parents in the suburbs for 3 weeks until my new lease began on September 1st. Had my landlord been required to prorate my August rent, I would have saved about $400, which is certainly not pocket change for any college students. I'm one of the lucky ones. For students coming from Greater Minnesota, other states, or other countries, staying with parents is likely not an option. They have to find and pay for short-term living accommodations in this period between leases, pay to store their furniture and other belongings, and absorb moving costs, all while paying a full month's rent for a lease that ended partway through the month. Student renters are effectively forfeiting hundreds of dollars for a service not provided to them. The language in Section 1 does not prohibit a landlord from creating a short-term lease. It simply says that they must charge tenants fairly if they choose to do so. Putting this extra money in the pockets of students would do a lot, especially as we are facing a growing college affordability crisis. That's more money that could be better spent on textbooks, healthy food, or, if needed, temporary housing between leases. According to the American Apartment Owners Association, prorating rent is a fairly standard practice when a tenant moves in or out mid-month. So why is this not the case typically on college campuses? One reason is that the current housing shortage on college campuses has created a landlord's market where students don't necessarily have the luxury of shopping around when they face unfavorable lease terms. Most national rental companies provide the same standard lease to all tenants, meaning prospective renters aren't empowered to negotiate the terms of their individual leases. It's also important to consider that for many students, a sophomore year lease might be the very first time in their life they're signing a legal contract. Without extensive experience as a renter, they assume that paying a full month's rent for a short-end lease is a standard practice, and the idea is further reinforced by the fact that their friends are all signing leases with similar provisions. This has put student renters at the whim of large rental companies that are already making a considerable profit off of these developments. Ultimately, the bill before you today is not about imposing unreasonable requirements or punishing landlords. It's about leveling the balance of power between consumers and providers in the college rental market. Student renters should be empowered to explore their housing options, knowing that there are basic consumer protections in place to support them. We ask you to please take an important step today to protect student renters by supporting House File 3759. Thank you.
Members, I don't know if any of you are newspaper readers, but this, a couple of days ago, I think it was in the Star Tribune, a front page article on college students who, because of rising tuition and rising housing costs, go to food shelves. They're looking for how they can afford food. So it's a whole different world for college students today. So, Representative Munson, is your question to the testifier or to the bill?
I would be to the Madam Chair, would be to the bill.
Do we want to get all the testifiers and then go to questions, or?
Yes, Manager, okay. Could we just have all the sure. testifiers go and then we'll answer questions for the
yes,
bill?
Please
Thank
proceed.
You. And the next testifier is Becca Cowan, and she's also a U of M student.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Cowan. I'm a third-year student at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also the local government coordinator for the Minnesota Student Association. I'm primarily focusing now on Section 2 of this House file that grants renters the first 4 months of a lease that is greater than 10 months long to sign a renewal for the following year. As Sam previously mentioned, the leasing cycle near the university generally runs from September 1st to the middle of August, with a gap before your new lease. This past fall, for example, I was forced to move out of my apartment in early August. I then stayed on friends' couches until my September 1st move-in. By September 24th, Millennium Management was already sending me a renewal for the 2020 September 1st lease. They expected this to be returned by October 1st. Thanks to language in our lease and a call to Homeline on the current regulations, we were able to extend this all the way to October 15th. Having recently undergone the stress of moving in unstable housing, my roommates and I strongly considered the impulsive, half-informed decision to renew our lease over 11 months in advance. However, the uncertainty and issues like landlord reliability and maintenance fixes forced us to find new housing. This issue is also not unique to Millennium Management. The Marshall Apartments sent emails requiring renewals by October 31st. The 700 on Washington required renewals to be signed by November 1st. My favorite is the Venue Apartments, whose lease states, the owner reserves the right to contract with others on the premises at any time for occupancy commencing after the end date, giving the tenants no guaranteed option of renewal. From conversations, this is also an issue around Duluth and St. Cloud. This situation is our main motivation for Section 2 of House File 3759, giving tenants the opportunity to renew their lease for the first 4 months of the lease, provided they are in good standing with the landlord. With most student-oriented leases, this gives renters from September to December or the entire first semester to make an informed decision on renewal. This then gives landlords the entire second semester to lease apartments prior to students leaving for the summer. We also felt this was a fair compromise that respected the rights of landlords beyond the 6 months called for by many and far beyond the 30 or 60 day notice used for numerous other leasing provisions. Regarding non-student renters, our conversations suggest the majority of leases are renewed closer to the 60 day range or contain automatic renewal provisions. This suggests the language in the second portion of the leasing bill would not greatly impact the rental experience or the behavior of the majority of landlords in the state. Thank you, Chair Hausman and members of the committee for your time. I strongly encourage you all to vote in favor of House File 3759 as a fair protection for young renters on campus.
And we have a third testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair. Our third testifier is the attorney with the U of M Legal Services.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. I am William Dean, and I'm an attorney at the Student Legal Service at the University of Minnesota. For those of you not familiar, that's an actual department of the University of Minnesota. And all we do in that department is represent students who have legal issues. So while we are part of the university, most of our work is done out in the community. And for the past 35 years, I've been the principal landlord-tenant attorney in the Student Legal Service office. And before that, I spent some years as a legal aid attorney in a legal aid office. So pretty much all of my career in law has been in housing. I was invited here today by the Minnesota Student Association representatives and by Representative Hurd just to add some perspective. I think Sam and Becca did a wonderful job of laying out the base issues, and I'm not going to repeat all of that. What I would like to do, though, is point out that there is an additional problem that I think they didn't see that I would see, and that is just how much movement of students is restricted when you have short-end leases. Now, the problem has gotten worse by the year, and so while I think Sam and Becca both testified that they had to move out like around the 12th of August, we're seeing leases this year requiring students to leave on the 3rd of August. That leaves a 28-day gap where they have to find housing. So one of the things that this does, it puts enormous pressure on students not to move, because if they sign a new lease, landlords will let them stay during the gap. And so it's essentially, it's a force that works against free movement in that marketplace that has created lots of problems. Of course, it's not just can you spend time on someone else's couch for 3 weeks or whatever. Where are you going to put your stuff? They want it all out of there. They don't want you to store it at the place you're moving out of. They want you to take it with you. So it's very difficult. It's not as difficult for the student who has the luxury of moving their stuff to South Minneapolis to home or to Bloomington to home, but it is a huge inconvenience for out-state students and for students coming from other states and overseas. The benefits of the statute would be that it would require tenants to be fairly compensated for time that's taken back by the landlord. And as Sam pointed out, no one's trying to outlaw the practice of taking back some of that time if that's what they really feel they need to operate. What we want to do is have them consider that in the context of what is the student or the tenant, in most cases, giving up. And that is they're giving up a lot of extra money for time they're not going to get. So they can still do it. They just have to work the compensation into the lease. And it will give landlords tremendous incentive not to keep expanding the period, because the landlords who first started doing this were doing it for maybe 3 days at the end of the month. Then it became five. And then over the course of the last 5 years, it's gone to 28 days on some of these leases. Well, if you have to pay for the 28 days, then you're probably going to be a lot more frugal about that. And if you feel like you can do your turnover and everything in 15 days or 10 days, then that's all you're going to ask for, because you don't have to pay for those extra days as a landlord. So I think it will give them a great incentive to consider what their actual need is versus just saying, well, a little more time helps me a lot. And there can be no question that that's got to help the landlord a lot. They have extra time to turn over, especially in larger buildings. And again, this is only going to affect landlords who actually choose to end their leases early. It's a choice whether or not you're going to be involved in this statute. If, as for the first 150 years of Minnesota, landlords choose to start leases on the first day of the month and end them on the last day of the month for a specified term, they're not going to face this statute at all. It has nothing to do with them. It's only people who want to get back time. So that's the part of it that I think is important for landlords to understand. They're opting in one way or the other. And again, it does protect tenants who are pretty vulnerable in a really, really tight housing market. And the idea that you might be living in a place where you're finding as you're going along you really can't afford to be there, so you would really like to seek cheaper housing, but you have no way to cover a 28-day gap at the end, so you sign on for another year, just adds to those pressures. So this would free the market somewhat for those people, I think, without much impact for the landlords. The second bill, I think, is, as Becca stated, important just in that right now there's so much pressure for a person who moves in to one of the high-rise apartments to immediately sign on for another year. The problem is a lot of these are in joint and several liability leases, and they're people that you met in your orientation group your freshman year, and then you maybe got to know them a little bit, and you moved in, and then over the course of a tenancy, you realize, I don't want to live with these people anymore. We're not compatible. But if you've already signed a new lease for another year, your options for breaking up that group, getting into a more compatible situation, getting into a more affordable situation, those are much more limited. So this just really creates a four-month period where no one can force a student or any other tenant to re-up during that period of time. Doesn't prevent a landlord, for example, from approaching people and saying, what's your experience? Are you thinking you might want to stay? I'll make a note of it, and then I'll talk to you at the end of the 4 months. And there'll still be a lot of that kind of stuff going on, but it won't be the pressure situation that we see now, which has been really detrimental to a lot of students.
Representative Munson has a question. To the author.
Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I'm finally collected myself after leaving my phone at home and having to go back, which is why I was late. I'm really sorry about that. I did just want to say really quick, because I did not say this in my introduction, is that this bill, there are two parts to it. The first section deals with the prorated rent, and then the second section, section two, deals with the pressure of landlords asking tenants to re-sign for a new lease right away just after they've moved in. And this is just saying, look, just give somebody a couple of months. They're still, you know, they're not asking for 6 months or 8 months, just a couple of months, 4 months, before going back to a tenant saying, you need to sign a lease for next year. And so just so that people know, there's two distinct parts of this bill. The other thing I did want to point out is that this bill does have bipartisan support in the Senate. And so we worked really hard, and the advocates who brought this bill forward worked really hard to ensure that that those who are on our colleagues from all sides of the aisle were supportive of this particular bill and the benefits of it. And so I just wanted to make sure that I put that out there as well. Thank you so much, Madam. Madam Chair, we are open to any questions that people may have.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Herr, I've owned a lot of property around the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, so I understand how that is common that people have to move out prior to the September 1st time, so that landlords can go in there and paint the properties and clean and then fix any damage that was caused by the students during that year lease. And in doing so, it allows the cost of owning that property to go down by, you know, basically, you know, 8%, because that's how much savings by not having the property vacant for an entire month to turn a property. Okay, so if all the landlords had people move out on August 1st, so they'd have a month to go in there and you know, fix all their units, then everybody would seem to be happy, but then all the students at the campus wouldn't have any place to live for an entire month, because oh, you're right, all the leases begin September 1st. And then if they were to end at the appropriate time on August 1st, they would displace tens of thousands of students. So so what was common and what is absolutely missing from all of your testimony is when tenants move out in mid-August, there's a lot of landlords that take them in early. I had a lot of tenants that would move in on the 14th of August, on the 18th of August, on the 20th of August, because their other landlord was working on fixing damage that they had caused during their tenancy. So we would, there's a lot of tenants that move in early, and we would rarely charge tenants, you know, if they're moving in 5 days early, we would just say, if you've paid your first month's rent, then we give you the keys if it's ready. And so a lot of tenants moved in without paying any rent at all for those 4 or 5 days or 8 days early. A lot of tenants would move stuff into the garage or storage unit ahead of time. A lot of landlords make accommodations for students because this is the culture around the U of M. The group of properties where maybe it's more rigid and it's less flexible are the really large landlords that, you know, there's a lot of the houses in the Marcy Homes area around the University of Minnesota where a landlord might own, you know, two houses. And so they're fixing them up themselves or painting, doing all the work, and they're not hiring this big professional crew to come in. So it helps keep the cost of housing down by not having to hire all these people to come in and you know, 6 hours to paint all the units. So it, again, it keeps the cost of housing down. I also heard about the words, you know, housing security. That's really important. When you're a student and you're maybe 18 years old, 19 years old, and you're off on your very own, and you're dealing with the stresses of college and grocery shopping and everything else, you want to have housing. You want to make sure you have a place to stay so you're not stressed out about it. So a lot of students like to know that they have a place to live next year. When they're getting towards finals and it's April and May of the year, they want to know they have a place to live next year. So they've already locked in that lease. Maybe even once school starts and they've found some friends that they'd like to live with next year, they want to sign the lease. And because housing is short around the University of Minnesota, landlords like to have security too to make sure that they know their property is going to be leased. And so they sign leases for the next year. So when you say that they must require the tenant to renew a lease, as a property owner around the University of Minnesota, it's nice to get everything locked in for the next year. So, I mean, if you're really saying that they can't require them, they could basically rent it out from underneath them. If somebody likes the property they're going to stay in for their last 2 years of college, then you're basically prohibiting a landlord from locking in the property. That's the way I read this, that they can't keep their tenant, so they're going to go lease it to somebody else. Unless the testifier, Mr. Dane, believes that a lot of leases have some kind of first right of refusal that's built into the leases, that basically it's increasing housing security by locking in a lease for the next year, and I think that's really important. But overall, I just want to ask Representative Herr, you know, where in this legislation does it just apply to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities? Because that's where I hear this problem is.
And I recall when we had an issue last year at the University of Minnesota that at the time Representative Bierman, whose children go to school in southern Minnesota, pointed out that his children have had some of the same issues. So I think that's why you're looking at this as a statewide issue and not just the University of Minnesota. Would it be Representative Herr or Mr. Dane?
Madam Chair, I'll answer a couple because Representative Munson had a lot of different things that he addressed in here, and I'll answer that, and then I'll turn it over for the right of refusal to Mr. Dane. And so, Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I appreciate the questions. We actually did talk to some, I actually talked to some landlords who I've never heard them say it would take them 30 days to fix a problem. They said on average like 5 days, and then potentially if it's a really big issue, maybe 10 days. And so I guess I don't see the argument for why somebody would need 30 days. I guess then I would ask the question back, well, when a student doesn't damage an apartment, do you give them that month's rent back because they didn't damage it, you didn't have to do any work? And so I just want to make sure that there's an understanding here that not every student leaves damage and then every apartment needs to be fixed, and some of the cosmetic things we've already been told only takes a few days to fix. And so requiring a student to move out at the beginning of the month or in the middle of the month and then collecting a whole month's rent, rest of the month's rent for that, to me doesn't seem fair in the power dynamics here. The also around how this is just a culture around the U of M, it is not just a culture around the U of M. We are experiencing this and seeing this around any city that has a college campus. And for the ease of knowing that we know that landlords own properties in multiple cities, it's not generally just one if they own And so instead of asking cities and municipalities to make their own laws and to have them all be different between municipalities, that having a state law actually creates the consistency that landlords need to know how to operate within all the cities versus having to understand from city to city to city that has a university, what their particular local laws are around the short-term leases. And then, and I did just want to address that around the college campuses, the issues of vacancies, the demand for units far exceeds the units that are available. So the issue of landlords not being able to rent out their places and not having the security of who's going to be in that unit for the next year is actually something we have not heard of. And based on the landlords who own around there, rare is the case where someone says, well, I just couldn't find somebody to come into my unit. The demand in those areas are so high. And it's not the few days that you're charging extra for to be able to fix an apartment that's keeping rates down. The rates are going up regardless, and it's the market that has been pushing the prices up. And so we just want to make sure that, like all things, when I've sold four houses, and in those times, if I'm out of the house before the end of the month, it's always prorated as well. And so I guess I just want to make sure that what is fair for homeowners is also fair for renters, and that I've never been asked to pay for a full month of my mortgage after one of my houses were sold and I was out, before the end of that month. And so I guess to me it feels like common practice, and it should be normal practice when somebody doesn't get to have a product or service to not have to pay for that product or service. And then I'll turn it over to Mr. Dane for.
Thank you. Representative Munson raises a really good point when he asks about the right of refusal. This legislation does not create any right of refusal for the tenant. And as far as I know, none exists in Minnesota law. Never heard of it, never encountered it. So this four-month period doesn't really give the tenant any extra right to stay. But what it does is it gives the landlord and the tenant a cooling off period where they can both figure out, are we compatible, does this situation work, before they think about entering into a lease for the next year. Your Representative Munson is correct in that he's saying it could be rented out from under the students who are in there. That, in fact, could happen. It's unlikely to happen for one very specific reason, and that is units that don't have to be turned over are the most cost-effective for any landlord, most the big, large corporations especially. So. They don't want to turn them over. That's why they want to talk to the students right away or the tenant right away and say, please sign on for another year, because they can check that one off. I've got it rented and I don't have to turn it over. That's going to be one of my money makers for the year, provided that there's no damage. So that's a tremendous incentive for landlords to want to get people to renew, and that's why they're pretty aggressive about it. And I agree with Representative Munson about for many, many years, it was the practice that if somebody had to move out earlier, somebody had to get housing a little bit early in the fall, you just kind of talk to your landlord and you make a little side deal and you move in. Well, it doesn't happen with the giant corporations. They just have strict, firm policies that absolutely prevent anybody from getting any exceptions. So last year, I have a very specific case, a student with a bed moving from one apartment to another with a three-week gap. Student happened to be an international student from Brazil, but anyway, he had no place to go with that bed. And so I talked to his old landlord, please, can you find him some space? No, I talked to the university. Do you have any storage, any place that we could put this kid's bed? Nobody has had a space. And then I finally talked to the new landlord, a landlord who over the years had had lots of problems with our office, but who immediately saw, this is a problem I can solve. And he said, I've got a little storage space and I can put that in there. So we're able to work it out. But the vast majority of people in that situation aren't going to call the law office to get help in finding a place for their bed. So many people have to abandon that property. That's another great added expense of moving that. So I think there's been a large shift in what we see in the marketplace, and those kind of handshake deals, which were a staple of our kind of landlord-tenant law for so many years, really don't happen much anymore. There's also, when you have the situation with the larger corporate entities coming on to campuses around the state and saying that we're going to put these strict rules in place and we're going to take back a bunch of time. You have a lot of pressure on the smaller landlords to do things that are similar because they have turnover issues too. They have to use some of the same people to turn over their properties, and obviously they're starting to look at the idea of, well, maybe I should be taking back some days. So the problem's getting worse, and it's expanding in its scope. It's not getting better by any means.
Representative Munson, follow up?
Yeah, so Representative Herr, I don't disagree with the first section of your lease because I think it's important that everything be prorated. That's fair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some, I haven't seen it where they're having people move out 28 days, but perhaps things have gotten worse. As far as the furniture and storage and stuff, I think the best time of year was when everybody had to put their furniture out on their lawn for like, I don't know if they still do that, but it was like, hey, let's go get some couches this day. And so people would run around and swap furniture. But the second section there, the early renewal, I have great problems with because we agree that landlords want to keep the tenants in, but they also want to lease out their property to keep their costs down so that they have they aren't going to be having a major loss the next year. It's really hard to find tenants in October or November. It's September 1st or not. And so a lot of people are looking a year in advance. So, but I just, when you say that the landlord must not require the tenant to renew the lease until at least 4 months have passed, I don't understand what the requirement here is. How do you define the require? If they're giving them a lease to sign, and if they don't sign it, they can lease it to somebody else. I think they were required to sign or they don't get to stay there. So, but that doesn't seem like, I mean, it seems like it can still occur. If you move in and 2 weeks later you get an option to renew for the next year, the landlord can still, you're basically requiring them to either sign or they'll lose the property next year. That's not going to change. This law appears to sound like it's going to make that illegal, but it won't. So I don't understand what your proposed legislation is actually doing. Because the landlord still has the ability to rent to somebody else if they don't sign it by 2 weeks after they moved in. So what exactly is your law doing, or your proposed law? Representative Herr, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Munson. I guess I'm not quite sure if Mr. Dane's testimony was when he said that landlords are incented to keep the same people in, and so whether it's they're going to ask the tenant to sign in 2 weeks or in 4 months, I guess it doesn't change that it's more cost effective for them to keep that same tenant. And we're just saying, don't ask 2 weeks after somebody just moved in. One, they don't know if they like the place. They don't know if they'll get along with that landlord. They don't know if they're going to get along with their roommates. They don't know any of those things. And asking them right away, especially like if you're a freshman or sophomore, like I have a junior. She could never enter into a contract and really know what it is she was getting herself into until she actually did it and then knows, oh, yeah, you know what, this situation's not going to work out for me. And we're just saying give students 4 months of living there before you would normally start your process of saying, we need you to sign another lease for next year. And so I don't think that it's unreasonable. And to be truthful, there actually was other groups that came to us and said that they believe that that amount should be 6 months. And the students were actually very reasonable. They said, look, we know the landlords need the time to actually refill this if we choose not to be here. So asking for 6 months is unreasonable because that puts us into second semester. They, you know, that puts them in a vulnerable position. So we actually already negotiated back that amount to 4 months to say that's a good compromise between like students kind of at least getting a couple months under their feet and then ask, because some of these tactics that landlords use are great. It puts an enormous amount of pressure on students to make decisions without having all the information to decide if they should sign on to another year. So I see your concern, but again, if market forces is saying that having a tenant renew their lease is the most cost effective and most profitable for a landlord, it's going to be the same whether they ask him in 2 weeks or four months. And so I just wanted to...
We have three more questions, so yes. I'd like to move on.
Madam Chair, she didn't answer the question because it doesn't say in here ask. It says that the landlord must not require. But your testifier had said that it doesn't prohibit them from giving someone a lease. So, this legislation doesn't do anything.
Yeah, and if a landlord doesn't want to, then they don't have to. If they say, okay, well, I'm not going to ask them because I've did 4 months, so after 2 weeks of them being here, I'm going to offer it to somebody else, then that's what the landlord does. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that, absolutely.
But it's, Representative, it's not banning the landlord from providing a lease.
This does go on to governmental operations. And I'm looking at the wrong notes here. Judiciary.
Yes, Madam Chair. And like I said, this law is not to try to prevent landlords from doing what is best for them. It's just saying if you're going to start pressuring somebody, just give them 4 months. And if somebody doesn't want to and they're like, well, I'm just going to lease this from somebody, I can write something that says that, but I don't think that would be the right thing to do either. So,
Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, Representative Herr. I got a couple of minor questions. First of all, I understand the concept of the bill, and I understand it. But I think it should be more geared toward college student housing instead of statewide blanket, because it affects a lot of areas that can actually increase the cost of housing for those that aren't going to college, which is what we're not trying to do. We want to get reasonable housing rates, whether it's leasing a home, leasing an apartment. We want to keep those costs down for everybody in Minnesota so we don't have people living on the streets. Something like this could actually increase the cost. Right now, I know I've talked to some of my property management companies in my area. My wife actually used to work in that business. Whenever they had a turnout where the lease got done 2 weeks before the end of the month, they already prorated that into the other months. It's already there. It's already built in. You talked, and I guess one of the questions I have, Representative Herr, if you could answer, the university also leases out space. It's the dorms. I know it's a mad dash for two or three days for everybody to move in, and they're given a certain time period to get all their stuff into their dorm, limited number of elevators to get it up to that top floor to the dorm. My niece actually had trouble because they couldn't get an elevator. They had to go down there. Took them 2 days to get unload one vehicle worth of stuff just because it was jam-packed with people trying to get their stuff in. Does this bill also affect the college dorm situation where with the leases there, or is this just dealing with the private property management?
Representative Herr or the attorney?
I'll take a stab at it first, Madam Chair, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Day. I guess I don't even know how that question applies to this particular bill, because the university doesn't charge a student month-to-month rent. They pay it in their, I have a student who I paid for the housing and the food plan and everything all in the tuition at the beginning of the month. I mean, at the beginning of the semester. And so I guess if the university was going to move to a month-to-month and then paying and telling everybody what every day cost, and then they're going to start having to prorate that, well, when they change their system of payment, then I guess this would apply to them as well. But I guess I'll let Mr. Dane answer that if this is applicable to university.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, the best analogy we have in the university setting would be some properties owned near campus by the University Foundation. If you follow things on the campus at all, years ago Cargill built housing near the campus called the Dinikin House, the Argyle House, and a couple of others. And after James Cargill passed away, that property became available for purchase. It ended up in the hands of the University Foundation, which is not the University of Minnesota, but it is a fundraising arm affiliated with the University of Minnesota. They own that property now. They rent that property out on a monthly basis, and they take back time from the end of the lease to toward the beginning of the month for cleaning and other things. Their leases have always clearly stated that the lease for the final month is prorated, your final month of rent will be, and it's much less than the other months. And so that's how it's been dealt with in the context of the closest affiliation to the university. But Representative Herr is right, with the housing contracts that students sign, we don't have an exact analogy to the private market. We do have that same turnover issue at the university, and we, I guess, have an advantage there because we don't charge anybody to live in the dorms over the summer except for in a couple of very specific places. So they're empty, and they have a lot of time to get them ready. So the prep of the dorm rooms isn't so much the same issue, but the turnover in terms of moving in the students is, and they move in more students in 2 days than probably the rest of Dinkytown does. So, you know.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, actually, if you look at it's a contract. A contract is the same type, pretty much similar to a lease. They're leasing those apartments or their dorms. That's where the problem with this bill, it's a statewide issue. They're statewide. I think it needs to be more geared towards student housing leasing. And whether it's the university, whether it's that profit, it's property management. The university is being a property manager, whether it's in the University of Minnesota, University of Duluth, wherever the college system has dorms, they're property managers. They would need to fall under this as well. So I think we need to take a closer look at it and gear it towards more of the college student housing issue and not make it statewide. It was also brought up where the kids are going to the food shelf for food. I went to college in the early 80s. Guess what? I went to the food shelf. That is normal. It's been normal for decades. It's an issue that I wish we didn't have to do, but we, unfortunately, it's an issue that we have to deal with. And I've seen Mr. Parmaker around quite a bit. The last couple of years, he's been in a number of my committees. And I commend you for doing this, but for both of you two students, I want to remind you of a sign that was above a door in one of the supply rooms where I was going to college. And it stated, your education begins your first day on the job, not in college. Your education begins on your first day on the job.
Representative Pearson has a question. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on Section 2 again regarding the early renewal. I understand it's not possible to request that the tenant sign a lease within those first four months, but if the renter wants to sign, is the renter allowed to sign in this bill?
Mr. Dane?
I don't think there's anything in the bill that would limit a renter from going to the landlord and saying, I want to sign a new lease.
All right.
What the pressure point is the other way. And it is entirely possible that that could happen. But what I would anticipate would likely be the case for most large-scale landlords is if they are worried about their lease up for next year, they're probably going to send around a little slip of paper saying, can you please let us know whether you have any interest in staying next year? That way they can sort out the ones who aren't going to stay from the ones who might stay. And when they get to the end of the four-month period, they know who to talk to. So,
thank you. Thank you. And a follow-up, yes. And I just wanted to, you know, go on record that this is a two-way street, and it's a big job for landlords to be able to communicate with their tenants and figure all this out. And the sooner they know that, the better. So as long as that's it's possible to inquire and to kind of know where people are standing, it's a constant communication thing. I wanted to address just the general fairness of this bill that I like about if you're there and you're renting, you get to you pay, and if you're not, you shouldn't have to pay. So I really like that part of the bill, and I think that a lot of people do that already in landlords across the state. But this issue, it does apply to the entire state. It's not just college students, and I think that general principle should be just state law. So I agree with the bill in that way in its entirety. I also wanted to address, you know, if Rep. Munson had a property and my kids were moving in, I would gladly rent from Rep. Munson. He understands the fact that, you know, you work with your tenants, you let people move in, and I deal with this all the time in my business with flooring. So we do a lot of rental properties, and I understand when the landlord says, I had some days for you, but now I lost them because this person needed a place to go. They're willing to move their stuff around for you. We go in and do that. Well, you know, we go into flooring jobs every day where people live there, and they move their stuff. We do our work. And my kids, as they've rented from people, they were always willing to let people to come in and fix things. They will make the time. They will open the door. They will meet them at the door. It's a give and take. And so it's just a matter of people being able to work with one another and getting the work done. So I understand that. Colleges, I always favored when my kids went to school in the dormitories because you'd pull up with your van and they had a flood of students there who would come out and load it all in for you. I love that. It's when they moved to the properties out in the community that it was me carrying the furniture in. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with Representative Bierman that this is a statewide issue, I believe. And I thank the students and Representative Herr for carrying this bill and bringing this forward. It's something I wasn't aware of, and I think that it absolutely does speak to fairness. That the prorating of the first section is certainly important, no matter who you are and where you rent. That what you're getting is the value of the property of the residents to be able to be there, and if you don't have access to that, you no longer have that value. And on the early renewal, I agree again. Representative Bierman talked about must not require. Certainly, there's the opportunity for a renter to say they'd like to renew the lease earlier. And then I just wanted to mention that food insecurity is a real issue with our students right now. You might have gone to a food shelf 20 or 30 years ago. Right now, it has become imperative for students to have access to food. And I personally have a student who is now the lead men president from my college, and that was his issue. I mean, they have a food shelf on campus because of that, and he's trying to grow that awareness of the need and of the concern with food insecurity. So I just wanted to be able to raise that as well. So thank you for bringing this forward. Representative Herr, I appreciate your advocacy as well on this issue. Thank you.
And you have one more stop to make, Judiciary Finance. And so Representative Herr renews her motion that House File 3759, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. Closing comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for hearing this bill. And I did just want to point out really quick that I know that there's been mentions again about how this is a university issue and this should be dealing with the U of M, but we also have private colleges and universities across the state as well. We know that this is Homeline and others who take calls, they hear this across the state. This is not, they're not just hearing it at U of M or at the U of M, you know, Duluth or at the U of M campuses. And so I just want to be really clear that this is across the state, is happening, and that's what makes our state great, is we have so many colleges and universities here. And so it is not just specifically a U of M issue. I also did just want to say really quick that there were actually a number of concerns about how we weren't actually going far enough on this bill and that we should actually be prorating to the hour that somebody's there. And as the reasonable person that I am, I said, no, I don't think that that's the right way for me to go with this bill, because that really then puts the burden on our landlords. And sometimes they let somebody stay for a couple extra hours. So then does the person pay the landlord back for those hours? And so, you know, there was just push that we could go further with this, and we decided we wanted it to be reasonable, which is why in the Senate we had actually gotten a verbal agreement from Senator Limmer that if we could get this through, all the way through it stops here, that he would give the bill a hearing in the Senate, so that because there already is bipartisan support, I hope that all of you support this bill as well, so that we can refer it over into Judiciary. So thank you so much for your time today.
Representative Herr renews her motion that House File 3759, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
That motion passes, and you are on your way. Representative Noor is he has arrived. Okay. Thought we didn't have our next author. I'm sorry. Okay. My understanding is you may have to step away, in which case Representative Hassan will step in for you. The chair will move that House File 3003 be referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present this bill. House File 3003 is a bill that requires installation of automatic sprinkler systems in existing high-rise building. Madam Chair and members, when I got the call the day before Thanksgiving, a tragic incident had happened in my district. Five people died. Jerome Stewart, Nadifa Mahmoud, Mariam Mahmoud, Taylor Barron, and Amatullah Adam. That was a tragic incident. And four people were injured, including a firefighter. I personally knew almost all of them because they lived in my district for a long time. If we could have had this legislation 25 years ago, we could have prevented this tragic incident. We have waited for far too long to pass this legislation. In fact, Governor Arne Carlson himself has said he made a mistake when he vetoed this same exact bill twice in the 1990s. We owe it to the families of those we lost in Cedar High apartment and to the firefighters who have had to respond to far too many of these incidents. Sprinklers are a simple, highly effective tool that should be fully employed in all high-rise, new and old. Minnesotans deserve to feel safe and secure in their homes. We can help ensure that they do have the safety in their homes and avoid preventable tragedy. I think we all agree that Minnesotans, including our seniors, people with disabilities, and families with children, deserve to live in safe homes everywhere in the state of Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to my testifier. We'll start with Tom Brace, who will walk us through the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Brace. By way of brief background, I'm a part-time employee of the National Fire Sprinkler Association. Prior to that, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years and the Minnesota State Fire Marshal from 1987 to 2003. And Representative Norris was talking about 94, 95 when a bipartisan bill passed twice and was vetoed. And the reporter that wrote the article quoting former Governor Carlson is in the audience today. A couple of quick points I wanted to make right off the bat in terms of disruption. We have an excellent speaker, time permit, that will go into how to install these sprinklers. My wife and I live in a small two-story home in a first-ring suburb. We had our home retrofitted, which is two stories, a basement. It was done while we lived there in 2 days. So in terms of, you'll hear stories maybe of terrible disruption and so forth, it's simply not accurate. Number two, there's been a question about just how many structures does this impact in the state of Minnesota. Fire Marshal Smith to my left, his staff is working on answering that specific question. A partial answer is an example. In St. Paul, it would affect about 11 buildings. A rough estimate is 100 or less somewhere in that that area. We heard about the people who perished in Cedar Riverside. There are two groups of people that suffered disproportionately loss of life. It's our seniors, 60 and over, our children, 10 and under. So the two greatest groups are at risk are our seniors, 60 and over, and our children, 10 and under. In Minnesota, which keeps probably one of the best record-keeping systems in the nation in terms of statistical reports from fire departments, seems to have a recent presentation seemed to show us that our seniors are even at a greater risk than we first thought. So not so much our children in this state due to a very accurate record-keeping system, but our seniors. This is just the kind of people, seniors and disabled people, that live in many of these public housing experiences. There's been a concern about money, and I know you'll probably hear something about that. Just to let you know, there's a couple of bills in also state government. We'll hear from that. But at the federal level as well, Senators Smith and Klobuchar have introduced a bill directly for $25 million, it's a start. It's a start toward this process. I'm a sprinkler advocate. I'm unabashed about it. It's the ultimate level of fire safety and fire protection. I'd close with 2 points. One, there has never been a loss of life in a property that was fully sprinkled. That track record is of genuine benefit to us here in Minnesota. They say you can't go home again, but clearly this bill is a repeat with some refinements, 94 and 95. We urge your support for this. It's long overdue, and we have the opportunity to correct a problem with a technology that exists back to the last century. This initially was for property, but now we've realized through time that protects life first and then property. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jim Smith. I am the state fire marshal. Since 2004 in Minnesota alone, there have been 64 fires that started on or above the seventh floor in high-rise structures. The greatest majority of these high-rise fires occurred in multifamily residences, and an automatic fire sprinkler system was present in each and every one of those structures. In those 64 high-rise fires, a single sprinkler head, one head, extinguished the fire in every incident, one head. The main difference between those 64 fires and the deadly fire that occurred at 4 a.m. in a small 400-square-foot apartment on the 14th floor of 630 Cedar is that no automatic sprinkler system was installed to protect the individual apartments or the residents who live there. Though the specifics remain unclear about how the fire started, we do know that the fire started in that small 400-square-foot apartment, and this tragic fire would have been quickly contained and most likely extinguished had there been the presence of an automatic fire system in that apartment. The mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect the lives and property of every single person that resides in Minnesota. Therefore, the State Fire Marshal Division has always and will always strongly advocate for the installation of automatic fire sprinklers in all high-rise buildings. Most importantly, those high-rise structures that are multifamily residences. Madam Chair, members of the committee, through this legislation, proposed federal assistance, and public-private partnerships, we have a path leading us forward to retrofit every single multi-story apartment building in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for your time.
I think we'll get all the testifiers up first before we end, so we have... Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Trinidad Uribe III. I'm the business manager for Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, chartered since 1903. Thank you for the opportunity to shed light on this very serious issue of non-sprinklered high-rise buildings. The occupants, residents, and first responders are at a complete disadvantage to survive if and when a fire were to happen. It's not just the fire itself, but also the deadly gases that are created by the burning materials inside these buildings. I am a Minnesota State Certified Journeyman Sprinkler Fitter with over 20 years experience in the trade, including over 10 years as an instructor for our apprenticeship program. Prior to me becoming the business manager, I'd have numerous opportunities to retrofit high-rise buildings, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and commercial buildings. The retrofitting of high-rise buildings regarding the residents of these buildings with calculated planning is not an intrusive process. In my experiences, residents would vacate while the installation process was happening in their units during the day, or even sometimes moving to a different room, or even being in the room itself while the installation was happening. In some of these cases, it would only even take a half a day for a unit to be completed in regards to installing the pipe. So this process of retrofitting can be done very efficiently and safely for the residents. As I explained in my testimony for the Public Safety Committee, time is of the essence right now to ensure that we will not have any more lives lost due to the lack of fire protection in any of these buildings in the state of Minnesota. These existing high-rise buildings without fire sprinklers lack the new technologies of the fire industry that newly constructed buildings have. This bill will give the opportunity to make these buildings safe for all. Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 represent those who fabricate, install, and maintain life safety fire protection systems within the state of Minnesota. We save lives and protect property every single day. My members not only work in the fire protection industry, but are great advocates for fire protection, and in some cases, sprinkle their own homes for the safety of their families and their property. We believe in fire sprinkler systems and strongly support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. My name is Abdusalan Mohammed. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of committee, for giving me this opportunity and support for HR 3003, a bill to retrofit automatic sprinkler system in certain existing high-rise buildings. On February 13th, 2020, I was in support and still in support of the bill, but I presented my arguments to the committee. I've got a question here. Does retrofitting sprinklers to an existing building cost money? You betcha, it will. The benefit of having one outweighs of not having one. According to the fire sprinkler industry, there are six different situations that put money back into the pocket of building owner once a sprinkler system is installed in the building. These are insurance savings, income tax deductions, life safety code compliance, federal legislation, liability avoidance, continuous business operation. The cost of having one is opposite to having none. And across the nation, cities are retrofitting automatic system to high-risk buildings. And our city, capital city, St. Paul, has done so. What St. Paul did is St. Paul Housing Agency, after 20 years, and was able to equip each of their 16 high-rise citywide with sprinklers in 2012. And another quote here. In Harris County, the fire marshal and the public housing information officer received an award that was reported sprinkler saves in Texas for the Texas Sprinkler Fire Coalition. In the same place, at the beginning of 2018, the Harris County Fire Marshal Office began tracking the effectiveness of fire sprinklers by documenting each time fire investigators responded to a fire seen in each a fire sprinkler system activated. By tracking fire sprinklers activation, fire sprinklers saved $144 million in property. No fatalities, no injuries were reported. Retired Fire Marshal Steve Zogart from Minnesota Fire Department said that sprinklers put directly on the fire almost immediately, long before the fire department can arrive. He also said it only makes sense to sprinkle these high-rise buildings and protect the thousands of lives that live in them. The fire that engulfed the 14th floor of the high-rise building, 630 Cedar Avenue South, Minneapolis, on November 25th, 2020, could have been avoided and was automatic, I mean, November 25th, 2019, sorry, could have been avoided. It was an automatic fire sprinkler install, but unfortunately, it did not get installed. And as a result, I lost my beloved mom, Nadifa Mahmoud, and also others did, as Representative Noor alluded. Those are Amatul Adam, Tara Baron, Jerome Stewart, and Maryam Mahmoud. There's also others who were injured and traumatized. Whenever I pass by my late mom's building or remember her, it always brings me to tears. But with faith and the good things she did for her family and for our community, makes me sometimes hold tears. I'm pretty much sure that the same goes for others, victims, families. Fire brigade members' lives are also important and should be protected at all costs. They are the ones who are in the line of defense, fighting raging fires, and without automatic sprinkler system, it puts In all honesty, there was negligence, and it should be not repeated again at all. Again, with Mr. Bryce here alluded to, and Representative Noor, in 1990, Governor Ann Carlson vetoed a similar bill, and he has come out and said, failing to pass the bill was a mistake. Please, committee, please build a political will to move from attention to action and make a real difference in the lives of high-rise residents with no automatic sprinkler system. I hope my mother and others do not die in vain. That finally got some remaining high-rise building profited with sprinklers. The victims were all Minnesotans, you betcha. They recognize you as all lawmakers, and for that reason, please do something for them and the others who are looking up to you all. How many lives would need to perish for this to change, please? How many lives would need to perish for this to change? I hope the answer is zero. Please, let the mistake Ann Carlson made be repeated. No doubt about it, sprinklers saves lives. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are very sorry for your loss. Yeah, thank you. We have two more testifiers, I believe, right?
Hassanin is not here.
It's not here. The next one is not here. So then we'll go to Kyle Burnt, Minnesota Multi-Housing. You think the other testifier is not here?
No, it's not. Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair, members. My name is Kyle Burns. I am the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We were saddened by the tragedy at the Cedar High Apartments last fall and sent our condolences to the family members and those affected. We are still evaluating the proposal, but wanted to highlight our concern for this proposed sprinkler mandates and the impact it could have on nonprofit and private naturally occurring affordable housing properties. Without funding, these facilities would likely see an increase in rents to offset the cost of the mandates. We ask the author of the bill and committee members to consider funding options to accomplish the sprinkler retrofit and ensure the facilities are both safe and affordable. We are ready to be a resource to the author and members on this issue moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And members, Mr. Brace talked a little bit about the funding issues. We know that's an issue out there, and between state and federal funding, we are looking for some options. In your packets, you do have that same issue brought to you by Common Bond and NARO, and I think that's the piece. We're realistic, and we know that you're going on to governmental operations and local government, and so I think that the funding issue will be a part of the conversation at the next level as well. Closing comments. Representative Munson had a question, but he had to leave, so no other questions. Oh, Representative, did we have?
Just a quick one?
Yes. Representative
Munson. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And Representative Knorr, I just wanted to clarify, how many units did you think this would affect? And we're talking are we talking the metro area, or are we talking the state?
Mr. Brace, I think you had a number earlier.
Madam Chair, Representative, the State Fire Marshal Division has been doing an analysis to answer that question. I think that's a work in progress. But let's use the term preliminarily. We think it's less than 100 buildings. And I cited, as an example, St. Paul. A senior code official in St. Paul said 11 buildings, and that would be residential and commercial business. So the number is we believe, and as I say, this is an ongoing work in progress. And I just wanted to make one quick comment. There is a new federal program that many people may not be aware of where you can accelerate the depreciation for a sprinkler retrofit. And that's been in effect for commercial property, and we're working now for residential property. But if you accelerate the depreciation, it makes the project much more affordable.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just need to point out that this is going to be really expensive, and we really need to figure out where the money's going to come from. I do appreciate that we're looking at 2032. Because I think it's going to take that long for us to figure it out, because we're going to have more issues than just, I'm sure we're going to have asbestos issues as well. So we've got to figure that. We've got those costs as well on some of these older buildings. So I really appreciate the discussion. We need to do something. I think we all know that. But we really have to be mindful of time and money and where it's all going to come from.
Madam Chair,
Representative Johnson, we'll get the rest of the questions in, yeah. And then you can have some concluding comments.
Chair Hausman, members, Representative Knorr, I understand and I appreciate what you're trying to do here. Going over some of the things on NAHRO issues, they have over $350 million of critical needs in the state of Minnesota right now in the housing industry, just on boilers and heating systems and elevators and plumbing issues already. And I appreciate that Senator Klobuchar has a bill to put $25 million towards this project. That won't even cover the 11 buildings in St. Paul. It is very expensive. It's not a very easy thing to do, and we have a lot of other needs. Then you have the issue where if they, in the HUD housing, if they put it in because of HUD requirements, they can't increase the rent to help cover those costs. Like I say, I appreciate what you're trying to do. We got to figure out some type of funding for this, because otherwise, if we push this through and don't have some funding in place and issues to help, I think we're going to intensify the housing issue because a lot of these buildings are going to close.
Representative Bierman, you asked? Okay, I think we're open for closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Madam Chan members. I hope for your support to take this bill to the government operations, and I look forward to addressing with all of you the cost that is associated with sprinklers. It's less than 100 buildings. I think we can do it as a state. It's a matter of safety and making sure that everyone has got a safe place to live. So thank you so much, Madam Chen.
And Ms. Brace, did you have any concluding thoughts?
I have one I am sympathetic. We are sympathetic to the tremendous demands, the fiscal demands on public housing. And we're working at the state level, we're working at the federal level to find financial sources. The one thing I would say, and there's a tremendous number of needs in public housing, respectfully, We're hoping that a mindset over time will develop through this tragedy that let's move sprinklers up the list of what needs to be done in the property.
I will renew my motion that House File 3003 be referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? That motion prevails, and you are on your way to the next committee. Members, I think that we are adjourned.